How did the KGB manage its network of informers? Was it an iron fist or the invisible hand? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. When the Soviet Union collapsed a generation ago, so did many of the structures of state control. One of these was its network of informers, carefully recruited and cultivated from among the Soviet people. Mark Harrison of the University of Warwick has spent a large part of his career digging through the archives of communism, and he's just published a paper on the economic principles of how these networks were built and sustained. Mark, welcome back to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim.
A lot of our listeners, they would have been born after the collapse of the communist states. So can you explain what this network of informers was and what they were informing on and who they were informing to, how many of them there were?
The Soviet Union was a police state, and the police themselves had the normal sort of informers that you'd find that any criminal police would maintain. But the security police also maintained informers to keep it supplied with human intelligence about any kind of threats to the regime. It's important to understand that the Soviet state thought of these threats very broadly. So they weren't just interested in assassins or people gathering secrets from the state. They were also interested in anybody who was spreading ideas or behaviors that might just be unsettling to the smooth order of a well-regulated society. And when I say a well-regulated society, what I mean is a society that followed the directives of the party and the government implicitly and to the letter across the entire length and breadth of the country. The KGB was interested in anything that caused disturbances in the street, made trains late, caused disruptions at work, as well as all the ideological things that you might think of associated with the dissemination of writing or culture, that sort of thing. As for who they were ordinary people in all walks of life. They weren't evenly spread through all walks of life. The KGB were particularly interested to watch educated people, young people, people in industrial centers or secret enterprises, of which there were many. So that's where they were looking mostly, and that's where they recruited most of their informers. On the whole, they watched the countryside with much less intensity. Relatively few of their informers were working on farms, for example. Although this is a country with a very large farm population, they weren't that worried about a peasant revolt. They were much more worried about what was happening in urban centres among young people.
And how many of them were there? Were there tens or hundreds of thousands?
There are various figures. I can speak about Soviet Lithuania, which is the country that I study, and the advantage of the countries in the Baltic is that they're now independent of Russian influence, and they've opened up their security archives. So in Soviet Lithuania, around 3 per thousand of the population were informers at the beginning of the 60s. It was rising through the 60s and 70s. 3 per thousand doesn't sound like a lot, but then if you start thinking, well, the population that the KGB was really targeting was young adult males, that starts to reduce the size of the population that was being closely watched by several multiples. But nonetheless, informers were always a scarce resource, and good informers were particularly scarce.
You've got first-hand knowledge of how this all worked, because you were living in the Soviet Union for a time in the 1970s, weren't you? Were you aware at the time that this network of informers was all around you?
Yes, although without any kind of certainty, because after all, this was the secret sphere. So there was a kind of open secret in Soviet society that informers existed and were at work. And so people talked about it a lot. People talked about it in confidential circles. So I had friends with whom I could discuss this sort of thing. People made jokes about it. And to some extent, I think the existence of jokes is the firmest evidence that we have that the existence and operation of an informer network was known about. But of course, the details of its operation and the identity of the informers was very, very strictly controlled. So that most of the time when we talked about these things, you know, I was a student in the early 70s, I visited as an academic two or three times later on, and when everyone talked about this thing, one was just feeling in the dark because everything was speculation and hearsay. So it was very hard to understand what the reality of it was.
If you didn't know that the person that you were joking with or complaining to, you didn't know whether they were going to report it back, does this mean that there's generalised a low level of trust within the society?
Yes, it does mean that. Mm. And I think that as a visitor, I was always myself aware that if anybody stranger came up to me and started asking where I'd been, who I'd been with, you know, who I was visiting, I should be discreet. I mean, that was personal experience. There's work that has been done more recently by a bunch of German economists. They've done work on the effects of the density of Stasi informers. The Stasi was the East German secret police across East German counties on levels of trust in East Germany today. They find a significant damaging effect. The intensity with which the population was under surveillance damaged present-day trust, and it also damaged present-day economic outcomes in terms of income and employment. Mm. And I think that's a significant finding on the long-term consequences of communist rule.
Your paper has some fascinating details about this. It's all taken from primary sources, isn't it? Where did you get the documents that you get your data from?
Well, the Baltic countries have now opened their KGB archives, so you can go to Lithuania and visit the KGB archive and read documentation there. The material I'm working with is relatively hard to find in the sense that when the KGB left Lithuania, the one thing it succeeded in doing was either destroying or removing nearly all the personal files of informers. So that one of the problems of the Baltic today is that the identities of most informers, most collaborators with the communist regime, remain unknown. But what I have is a few documents that were left because in the 60s and 70s, the KGB was interested in self-improvement, and it spent some time gathering up information about successful recruitments, what makes a successful agent, how did we recruit them, how do we manage them. And these are the files that I'm working with. They don't contain the real-life identities of the agents, but they contain a great deal of other information, much personal information, and a considerable amount of narrative. So this enables one to see what the KGB considered to be successful cases of recruitment and how these recruits were managed.
Yeah, it really comes through in your writing, the detail and the precision of the data that has been captured and categorised. Is this typical of the sort of record keeping that there was in the Soviet Union?
Yes, the Soviet dictatorship wrote almost everything down. If you compare it with the history that we have of Nazi Germany, it's clear that Hitler, for example, did a great deal of business over the dinner table or in ways that were never written down, and many decisions were made that could not be attributed to him in writing. And this was not true of the Soviet regime. One of the features of the Soviet regime was to write everything down. I think in a way it's symptomatic of a low-trust regime. Senior Nazis trusted each other, and so they did not have to commit everything to paper and sign it in their own blood, whereas the Soviet system relied a great deal on writing things down, getting written commitments from people, and making people sign things. You know, Stalin took great pains to make sure that his colleagues kept on signing execution warrants and this sort of thing. They didn't need to sign it. These people were going to die anyway. But it made sure that everybody's hand was dipped in the blood. So the level of documentation of what went on in the Soviet state is tremendous.
And very useful for a historian like you. So tell us a little bit about the informers in this data. Do we know how they ended up being informers, what it was about them that meant they got recruited?
Most of them were just ordinary people, but most of them had a troubled past of one kind or another. And it's important here to understand that Lithuania itself had a tortured 20th century history. It was a province of Russia before World War I, then independent between the two world wars, then invaded and occupied and reinvaded and reoccupied through World War II, first by Stalin, then by Hitler, and then by Stalin again at the end of the war. But through this period, many Lithuanians faced terrible choices, life and death choices, and many of them made bad choices of a kind that I think can only be really understood by people who live in small countries that are close to great powers. By the end of the war, many Lithuanians had all sorts of what the Soviet regime regarded as stains in their past. Not only that, there was a real-life insurgency going on for 7 or 8 years after the war, and a continuing nationalist resistance, defeating which was one of the KGB's first priorities. So there were many people with compromised pasts, many people that the KGB wanted to watch, and they wanted to recruit informers among them. The people in my very small data set were anything from sort of choir singers to port dispatchers to journalists, teachers, priests, all of those fairly everyday occupations. But they ended up working for the KGB because they knew things that the KGB was interested in, they knew people the KGB was interested in, and the KGB singled them out as targets for recruitment.
There are a lot of aspects of this relationship between the informers and the KGB that seem counterintuitive at first. First of all, there is that the informant signs a contract. And you're arguing that this was a contract in the sense that an economist would recognise it's not just the KGB making them an offer they can't refuse.
Well, the decisive moment in the recruitment process was the signing of an agreement. And this agreement was really entirely one-sided. And not only one-sided, but open-ended. The informer-to-be would handwrite on a sheet of paper some form of words, which is very variable, but was generally something like, I promise to collaborate and to keep the facts of my collaboration secret, and then would sign with their code name. This is the moment at which the informer was issued with a code name. So, of course, this doesn't look like a contract, but in many legal systems, including our own, a contract can have unwritten aspects, verbal aspects and implied aspects. I think if you look at the process more closely, you see that this was such a moment because very often there was a reciprocal promise on the part of the KGB. It varies a little. If you think of the loyal person or the disloyal person, the loyal person would have their status affirmed, would have a position of respect in the Soviet state, although a secret position. And this was clearly important to a number of people. For the less loyal or disloyal person, there was a promise of protection. That is, we will protect you from the consequences of your past actions, which we would otherwise pursue you for. And, of course, this was the element of blackmail or pressure that was sometimes present. Having said that, in most cases, informers went on the surface willingly into recruitment. That is, they didn't object. They said, OK, I'm willing. You can read a lot into that too, of course, because I think in many cases they were simply anticipating that it was better to agree quickly than to be humiliated and forced into recruitment.
This contract is incomplete. Many of the obligations and rewards are implied. So how is it possible for the KGB handlers, the managers, to manage that working relationship?
Well, in some ways, it reminds me very much of the position of an academic and students. Every student on the surface wants to be in university. They don't look like unwilling recruits. Nonetheless, some of them have been sent there by their parents. You know, everybody wants a degree, but not everybody wants to do the studying that leads to the degree. And so you have to monitor them. We monitor our students by setting them assignments and checking whether they submit the work. And if they don't submit the work, then we chase them. We try to find out what's missing in their motivation. And the position of the KGB informer handler was very similar to this. That is, the first thing was to get the informer to sign the agreement. And then you start setting them simple tasks and you give them a little bit of training and you see how they perform. And one of the things that's clear is that this is quite a human capital intensive process in the sense that one of the things that the handler would do would be to set other informers to watch the new informer. This seems to have been a fairly normal part of the process. You need to find out whether these people are really going to serve the Soviet state loyally and truthfully. And there are often reports about, we know that this informer began to tell us the truth because either we were eavesdropping on them or there was another informer watching them. So the KGB was very aware that somebody might well sign up as an informer but then have second thoughts, might fail to show up for meetings, might fail to write the reports they requested. And even if they did, they might not be telling the truth. So it would take time for the informer to receive a sort of stamp of verification.
It's really interesting what comes through this is the relative absence. As you say, there was some coercion, but the relative absence of coercion in developing this relationship, which was invested in by both sides.
I think one of the keys was that the KGB would perhaps be interested in a bunch of people, maybe a bunch of students or a bunch of former nationalists or ex-cons who've been released from prison and gone home again. And they noticed that one of them is starting to show signs of perhaps distancing themselves from the group or showing some kind of second thoughts, maybe regretting the past, wanting to get back into respectable society. And if they pick the right moment to gather that person up, that person will be a willing recruit, because then they're opening up an avenue to salvation for someone who's no longer very happy with the fact that they have this stain on their character. Everybody regards them as a bad sort who did bad stuff in the past. And so this helps to explain why there seem to be many cases where former nationalists, former collaborators were picked up by the KGB, were used as informers, and generally they went willingly. And I think probably in most cases there's some kind of balance of regret for their past and also fear of the consequences of not accepting recruitment. And you can never be sure exactly what that balance is. In some cases, it's fairly clear. I mean, there's one guy that I write about. His past was as I've described. That is, under the German occupation, he was a bit of a low-level collaborator. And this then caused trouble for him after the war. And he wanted to have a respectable, honorable position in society, but he kept on being refused promotion or being made to change his job. And he figured that this was because of his past. He was a journalist, so he had an opportunity to mix with foreigners. And when the KGB offered him a chance to become an informer, he just jumped down their throat. He was so happy. And to read the documentation, it's fairly clear that they had no doubts that he was sincere. He then became a very productive informer. And so in his case, becoming an informer was kind of a route out of the morass that he felt himself mired in because of his mistakes during the war.
It's a very vivid piece of historical research, Mark. But does it tell us anything about the way we live today or the way we work today or the way we manage today?
I think for most of us, it tells us that we're lucky. We're lucky to live in a liberal democracy, and the ease with which we can live and associate and open our mouths in a liberal democracy should not be taken for granted, but often is. It's only 40 years since these regimes existed across half of Europe. In some cases, they show signs of coming back, the restoration of authoritarian rule. In Western societies, there's plenty of evidence that people are tired of democracy, feel that democracy doesn't always give good results. To some extent, I'd like people to know, are you sure that you'll enjoy what you wish for if we go back to a more authoritarian society? So I think this has a little more to tell us than, well, it's just a piece of history.
Mark Harrison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Working Papers, published by the Centre for Competitive Advantage in a Global Economy at the University of Warwick. It's number 408, and it's called Contracting for Counterintelligence, the KGB and Soviet Informers of the 1960s and 1970s. And you'll certainly want to be downloading that if you're one of Mark's students. That tells you about the relationship that he has with you as well. Mark, thank you. Have you ever found files on you in the archives? Do you know that you were informed on when you were in the Soviet Union?
I've never seen my files. My files are in Moscow. I'm certain that they exist. I've seen how the KGB watched foreigners and students in Soviet Lithuania. I used to wonder whether my file existed. Now I'm sure it does.
Well, one day you might find out what's in it. You can come back on Vox Talks and tell us about that as well. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, our early stage research takes you to places on planet economics that you didn't know existed. So sign up on your podcast platform and visit our archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.